You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Pete Tesoris. He's a retired analyst of military all-source intelligence for the U.S. government, both the National Ground Intelligence Center and the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's also a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve and has written 30 books on military history and alternate military history as a military historian and biographer. One of these books is Major General George H. Sharp and the Creation of American Military Intelligence in the Civil War, and that's what we're going to go and talk about today. So welcome, Pete. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Real pleasure.
So whenever I get a book like this, and it's a large book, I mean, this is a hefty, you're getting your money's worth when you buy a book like this. I usually flip to the bibliography and the notes because I know how to party, and that's I'm not the most interesting person. But what I noticed is there's tons of primary sources in this book. And what makes me wonder about this is not a new story. You know, we didn't just find out about George Sharp a couple years ago. This is obviously 150 plus years ago. Why hasn't there been a real biography of Sharp up until this point? This is really the first comprehensive biography of a man that's not like he's been secret for so long.
Well, he has in many ways. If you read almost all of the major books on the Civil War in the Eastern Theater, he hardly appears. Okay, he came back to life when Edwin Fischel wrote his wonderful Secret War for the Union in 1996. Fischel was an NSA analyst. Starting in the 1950s, he started to do research on Sharp for this book, which took the Union intelligence effort in the Eastern Theater up until Gettysburg, okay? And there's a great deal of information about Sharp, and I read this and was utterly fascinated. Okay, what about this man? You know, he had not appeared anywhere else. So I said, this would make a great biography. And as a former intelligence analyst, or I was actually an analyst at that time, I thought, this is fascinating. No one's ever really talked about this sort of thing before. So I started out with his 20 surviving letters that are in the Senate House Museum in his hometown of Kingston, New York, and transcribed those because it's hard to go back to 19th century handwriting back and forth.
Right.
So my wife helped me figure out what a lot of the, you know, meant. And now I'm really conversant in his writing. But it was only 20 letters, wartime letters. And I said, well, what else? Well, then I discovered online the official records of the rebellion that you could download in Word. And there was a ton of materials on Sharp. All of his messages, his reports, everything like this was in there. So I downloaded these, and I started putting them into a database, chronological database. Then I went to the archives, and I used a vacuum there. All of the military service records of Sharp and all of his people and people associated with him, and I transcribed these by hand, into Word. A friend... Bill Feiss, who wrote another great book. He was a protege official. Lent me the BMI records, the Bureau of Military Information records that are in the archives. And so I printed all those out and transcribed those again into Word. Hundreds and hundreds of documents, right? I got the telegrams sent back and forth. Then I scoured the Library of Congress, and they had in there the John C. Babcock collection. And Babcock was his civilian deputy, who is his order of battle man.
Who had worked for Pinkerton before.
Yeah.
He'd worked for
him. Yeah, briefly. And then just scoured everything in the presidential records at the Library of Congress for references to Sharp in his post-war life.
This had to have taken years. How long did you do this research?
Years.
For? Years.
I started in 2007 and published it last year, so it was basically 11 years. So I had this database of thousands and thousands of documents. And the utility of this is that you read them chronologically, and you're finding out exactly what the Union commanders knew, which has never been done before.
Right. What they knew and when they knew it.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, that's like, I've looked at a lot of World War I deck logs, mm-hmm. you know, for American ships during World War I. It's exactly that, right? You have a day-to-day about what was happening. I mean, that to me is a fascinating mm-hmm. way of looking at this.
Well, I also found Babcock's journal, official journal, that covered about 3 or 4 months in after Gettysburg. And which indicated that there were a lot more of these, but none of the rest have survived. This mm-hmm. one was in the archives, and it was every day what information they had been bringing in, mostly from prisoners, and because he was the order of battle man. Sharp got in a huge amount of information from interrogations and debriefings and so on. One of the most useful sources he had were contrabands, mm-hmm. the slaves who escaped. And the Confederates were very indiscreet in talking about around them. They treated them like furniture. And so you'd have these people come in, they were the body servant of a general, and out would come this incredible order of battle data, because many of them had wonderful memories. In fact, Charlie Wright came in, he came in, the cavalry captured him right before Gettysburg, and Sharp's other deputy, Captain John McEntee, went down and talked to him, and he related how Lee's army was moving through Gordonsville into the valley for the invasion, and he talked about the two corps that had moved through when he was there, and he identified every regiment.
Right.
He had that good a memory, and they checked it against their order of battle. I mean, it doesn't get any better than
right.
that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like having a satellite, right? To be able to just watch them and kind of pick up one by one somebody that's that fluent in understanding who they are and who the leadership is and everything else. Yeah. Well, let me ask you about this, because you spent that many years, and you're very honest in the book about kind of liking and admiring George Sharp by the time you were done. Is that a problem? I mean, I know it's a problem with people who write biographies. Is that something that you were cognizant of? Is treating this man objectively and writing a kind of a true biography, or was it okay to kind of admire somebody who was the subject of your book?
Well, I thought it was fine. I mean, he was an admirable man. How could you not respect and admire him? The way he behaved in his writings, interrogations, whatever. He never uses the N-word. Other people did, right? In fact, he had been a great supporter of African-American civil rights after the Civil War as a politician in New York. He was a kind man. He took care of his regiment. He remained the colonel of his regiment, even though he was acting as the, in effect, the G2 of the Army of the Potomac. Because his commission, it was a state commission tied to that regiment. If he had given up command, he would have lost his commission. So he was always consulted about what was going on in the regiment. He would visit the men in the hospitals. They would give him their pay, meant for their families. He would take it down to the Nest Bank with a gold dome here and deposit it, and then write a check to his uncle at a bank in Kingston, New York, with the list of how much money to give the dependents. He was the only, this was the only case of an allotment system that I know of that was set up for the families, right? And after the war, he was the only general to build a build a statue to his regiment rather than the other way around.
Right.
And so the book is full of evidence of how he truly cared for all the men in his regiment, and he showed kindness to other people that happened to come into his orbit. Also, he was charming. He was a hail fellow well met. He was a world-class raconteur that could have given Lincoln a run for his money.
Yeah, you talk about the storytelling. I mean, I kind of think of today, he was a colonel at the time, and he's around people like Grant and Meade and others. And they want him around because he's just a good storyteller.
Oh, he is, yes.
And it is strange. I mean, even anyone who's been around the military is a, kind of a lowly colonel kind of holding court with all these generals and just kind of being the center of attention, especially with some of the egos of some of these generals that are just willing to let him kind of take center stage versus themselves.
He became one of Grant's family of generals, which was a very select group of people that Grant absolutely trusted. Which says a lot for his character. He became a lifelong hero worshiper of Grant. And when Grant was dying of throat cancer, or mouth cancer, whatever, he rushed to his home and said, please, let me take him to my mansion in Kingston, New York, where the air is much better, and so I'll take care of him. And they said, no, he's too far gone. He can't be moved. But Grant made him the, Grant truly trusted him in this crisis of in 1870. Grant was not going to let the Tweed Ring falsify another federal election to the House. So he appointed Sharp as the U.S. Marshal of the Southern District of New York, first to conduct an honest census and then an honest registration of voters. And the Tweed Ring wasn't going to put up with this. They had death threats to him. Grant put him in charge of the entire military and naval garrison of the city of New York. He allowed him to hire 5,000 marshals and arm them. And the Tweed Ring was going to call out the National Guard, which they controlled, to bully people at the polling stations. And then Sharp had a come to Jesus talk with the mayor, and the Tweed Ring blinked.
Yeah, this was Tammany Hall and the kind of famous machine, political machine.
Yeah, they won the election, honestly, because they had such patronage among immigrants, but their power broke up after that.
Let's go back about 30 years, or, 20 years from that, and look at the United States Army prior to this establishment of the BMI, and what was expected of a commander, even moving into the early Civil War, so, in 1860-61. Most commanding generals at that point were kind of their own directorate of analysis, their own analytical staff. They didn't have people there bringing in the information. They were just getting the raw intelligence themselves prior to the Civil War. That seems really problematic when you're talking about a war of that scope, like the Civil War, where you're talking hundreds of thousands of soldiers and information an entire continent is bringing in.
Well, you have to understand the traditions of the U.S. Army and the fact that it had been very small. So a commander, basically, unless you're going back to the Mexican War, the largest number of troops that anyone had commanded had been a company. And so the company commander, or if he was even a higher rank, he doesn't have more than a few companies in any particular operation. He could do his own intelligence work. And going back to George Washington, who was his own G2, and a brilliant one at that, but again, the scope was very small. But what really changed was the fact that now you had the people in arms. You had the scope of war had expanded beyond any ability of one general to be his own G2 anymore. And the man that recognized this was General Hooker. He had a taste for intelligence. He had, in effect, as a captain in the Mexican War, commanded a division as an advisor to a volunteer general, and he was very forward thinking. He came up with many innovations. So, for example, creating the cavalry corps, creating unit patches to give identity to the men, and so on. And he realized that he couldn't be his own G2 anymore. He had to professionalize it. And how he chose Sharp is a fascinating little story. At Fredericksburg, right before Hooker becomes the commander of the Army of the Potomac, Sharp's regiment, the 120th New York, was next to another regiment with a large number of French immigrant volunteers, and the colonel was not a French speaker. He gives a command. There's a lot of confusion. They don't know what to do. And Sharp, who had learned fluent French in 3 years in Paris before the Civil War, rides over and in perfect parade ground French gives the command, and the regiment moves into line. Well, Sharp was in Hooker's corps, and this comes to Hooker's attention, and then when he becomes commander, he calls in Sharp and says, look, I have this book in French on how to set up a secret service. Can you read it? Yes. Can you translate it? Yes. How fast? As fast as I can read it. Well, he did. And with a further interview with the provost marshal and the chief of staff, he got this brand new job that he had to set up. And it was almost from scratch, except for John C. Babcock, mm-hmm. who was the only one with any experience. But this was, I think, the 13th of February when he gets the job. And in the short time between then and the 28th of April, when the Army sets off for the Chancellorsville campaign, he had created a fully functioning all-source intelligence operation.
You mentioned all-source intelligence, and Hooker seemed to be trying before the BMI was created, before Sharp. And you do a good job of this, but I went through and I pulled out the different sources of intelligence that Hooker was trying to use before he brings Sharp in. Part of it was pickets trying to pick up bugle calls and trying to figure mm-hmm. out where everybody was. Interrogation, of course, as you mentioned before. Actual spies trying to recruit people in the South to provide information. Using scouts not only to do scouting, but also to kind of be handlers for the spies. The Balloon Corps under Thaddeus Lowe, which was not necessarily run by Hooker, created by him, but he was using that information. The Signal Corps, which was bringing in information and doing somewhat kind of counterintelligence. And then also analysis and reporting that was kind of tucked in.
Don't forget the cavalry.
And the cavalry, which is
very jealously guarded, what they considered their rice bowl of
exactly.
Collecting intelligence.
What was interesting, you talked about Babcock, but you got Butterfield and Patrick are also there as being kind of helping. And Butterfield's interesting, if you don't know the name out there listening, you certainly know a composition that he's made, known at the time as Butterfield's Lullaby. I guess today we know it as Taps.
Yes.
And these are guys who Hooker depended on for essentially doing staff work, and they're integral for Sharp in the BMI as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about the Civil War on the Union side was there were a lot of volunteer generals who had full professional lives. They were used to managing large organizations and managing technology, emerging technologies, all right, which was something the U.S. Army just didn't have. And so you had someone like Butterfield, who was a very talented man. He engineered a major deception of Lee's army, all on his own. So these were talented men. General Patrick was kind of a Puritan, brimstone and thunder sort of guy, strict disciplinarian. What Hooker did is they tried to find a place for Sharp's new organization within the organization of the headquarters, and they decided, well, the provost marshal had done a lot of this with prisoners and so on, so we'll make Sharp the deputy provost marshal. Okay, so that's where he resided through most of the war. And it worked out pretty well because they had to process a large number of prisoners, and prisoners were a major source mm-hmm. of intelligence. Patrick, however, did not get along with the unique personalities always that were attracted to intelligence. You know, because he was such a strict disciplinarian, he didn't like the way a lot of the scouts, were kind of loosey-goosey with discipline and things like this. But they managed to overcome most of this. You know, inevitably in any military organization, there's going to be certain frictions. But by and large, Marcena Patrick supported Sharp very well. And Butterfield used him very well. Hooker said, these are your specific responsibilities. Interrogations, debriefings, spies, scouts, analysis, order of battle, okay? But I want you to coordinate with everybody else.
Right.
Right? Coordinate with the cavalry, with the signal corps, with the balloon corps, and even anybody outside the army that you feel necessary. And he put him in touch with the provost, civilian provost marshal of Maryland. And the two of them worked beautifully because Baltimore, where this guy was located, was connected to Richmond in this spy channel. You know, they'd go back and forth. It was a major source for spies going in either direction. So he got a great deal of information about this, and they're helping each other all the time. This is one of the great things where you find military success is where for you have people helping each other. You know, without the, for example, what I call the intelligence agency tribalism that we had before 9/11 and still there, you know, I think. So he was always willing to help anybody.
But even in this case, you write that there was not yet quite an intelligence system in place because the cavalry arrested the scouts and wouldn't let them through sometimes, that the mail didn't get exploited in the correct way and the cavalry was reading the mail without really understanding it. Scouts being used by generals for guides and couriers and not actually doing their jobs.
Well, this was towards the beginning of the creation of the Bureau of Military Information, but things kind of settled down after a while and you developed SOPs and people understood the proper relationships and so on. Then you had another bump. After Gettysburg, General Meade decided he was going to be his own G2. Sharp could keep those areas that he was responsible for, but Meade and his chief of staff would put everything together. And there was a great deal of friction there. And unfortunately, Meade, as Grant would later say in his memoirs, was a very capable officer who degraded those capabilities by his inability to get along with anyone. And there's a story in there that Sharp told years later that when they were besieging Petersburg and they're at City Point, the headquarters, several senior British officers came as guests and they met Grant, and Grant wanted to send them down to Meade for a tour of the siege. And he calls in Sharp and says, do you know any generals that General Meade is on speaking terms with? And Sharp said, I'll take them, you know? So it's interesting that Meade never discusses Sharp in any of his, in any of the post-war collections of his correspondence.
Yeah, which is, we'll get to Gettysburg in a second, but knowing how the relationship, the dynamic worked at Gettysburg seems strange because, you know, Meade at that point may have lost that battle without Sharp's intelligence and argue probably would have lost that battle without the BMI provided information.
Well, I think so, but see, I think one reason they did work together so well then is under the pressure of events.
Yeah.
Meade was brand new in that job, 3 days in that job.
Right.
And he had to rely on these the people around him. At Gettysburg, I say in my book that Sharp was responsible for three golden gifts to Meade at the tactical, operational art, and strategic levels of war, and that few U.S. Army commanders have been so well served. The first was at the tactical level was the night of the 2nd of July after the terrible fighting where they nearly broke, where Longstreet nearly broke through. And
this would be Little Round Top, and this would be, if people know the history of Gettysburg, this is Joshua Chamberlain's charge and all that stuff.
Oh yes, that day. Yeah, and also the where the last Confederate brigades nearly broke over Cemetery Ridge.
Right.
Okay. That night, everyone is exhausted. Meade is calling a meeting of his corps commanders to sound out their fighting spirit. And he says to Butterfield, have Sharp report to me what reserves Lee has. Now, Sharp, during the battle himself, had been used as a senior staff officer. And he had let his order of battle people do their work. They had collected, they had probably about 2,000 prisoners by then captured on the first 2 days. And it was Babcock who actually wrote the report, but he signed it for Sharp. Now, that report, a photocopy of that, not a Xerox, but a photocopy of that, exists in the official papers at Georgetown University, in his collection there. And I could not find it in the archives, and possibly because Fishel wrote at some point that after he made known the existence of the BMI files, someone went in and stole 150 documents. Right, the FBI recovered 50 or 100, but the others, probably including this one, are gone. But it is in Babcock's handwriting, so it's not a forgery.
Right.
And it said, we have identified every regiment in the Army of Northern Virginia except those in Pickett's division. Boom. Now, Meade knows exactly the reserves that Lee has on the battlefield. Pickett's division was the smallest of the nine in Lee's army. And actually, it was weaker than they thought because it had started out with five brigades, but two had been detached. So recently, they had not been able to pick that up. Okay? Well, then Meade says, look, I've got 22,000 men in reserve, as opposed to what they thought was 7,000, but it was closer to 5. Okay? So this steals his resolve to fight there, and as well as his corps commanders say, stick it out, you know.
Right, because he didn't want to fight there in the first place. I mean, Meade
no,
did not.
He left his most of his trains and his engineers behind on Pipe Creek along the Maryland-Pennsylvania border, which is why the Army went hungry.
Right. The idea was to pull Lee toward Washington to set up a defense, you know, with your actual logistics behind you, instead of fighting in Gettysburg, where it was unintended. And then, of course, but Sharp's intelligence said, we can win this thing.
The second gift, okay, involved Captain Ulrich Dahlgren, one of George Meade's aides. This man was a born special operator. He volunteered for every special mission. He led a raid across the Rappahannock into Fredericksburg, right, just boldly right into the city. And then he volunteered to go along at Brandy Station, and he assumes command of a regiment when their commander's shot, and he cuts their way through a Confederate encirclement, whatever. And he was the best dancer in Washington. Handsome, blonde young man, the son of Admiral Dahlgren, the father of American Naval Ordnance. On the 30th of June, Sharp's chief of scouts, who had a great talent for riding with the Confederate Army, passing himself off as a Confederate soldier. He had been doing this, and he came back, and he said, lo and behold, I found out that the Confederates are expecting major dispatches to come through Greenville, Pennsylvania, which was along their MSR, on the 2nd. Now, he's reporting to Sharp. Dahlgren hears it. It's a very small headquarters, okay? And he says to the chief of cavalry, give me 20 men and I will seize those dispatches. Well, he gets 11, but Sharp gives him his chief of scouts and three of his best scouts. So these 16 guys or whatever head out. They get to Greencastle, cutting the story a little short, and Dahlgren goes up to the steeple of this church in the center of town, and he looks north. He sees this wagon train with the loot of Pennsylvania coming south with a company of infantry as train guards. And then he sees south coming north, a cavalry company, they call them companies back then, not troops, coming up. And he says, that's got to be the escort for the couriers. So he hides his men behind the building. And as the two columns meet, they charge. And the element of surprise, you know, he's got, 16 men? And they panic, two full Confederate companies. They capture 17 Confederates including the couriers, two couriers, and big bags of mail and sharp. I mean, Dahlgren is dumping them out and he's looking through it, but there are no dispatches. But the chief of scouts, Milton Klein, is noticing that one of the couriers is staring at his saddle. So he goes over, and underneath the saddle is the leather dispatch case. And inside are two dispatches, both to Robert E. Lee, one from the adjutant general of the Confederates and the other from Jefferson Davis. And what does he do as a good intelligence officer? He opens them and reads them. The one from the adjutant general said, "Oh, Lee's really mad at you for your suggestion that you sent him before you left to create a small army under General Beauregard by pulling all of the garrisons in the Eastern Theater into Northern Virginia and threaten Washington from the south." In fact, apparently Lee had leaked this, right, so as to be a deception,
right,
to distract the National Command Authority in Washington, thinking that not only is Lee coming down on them from the north, but Beauregard's coming from the south. And the adjutant general also says, "Can you detach a couple of your brigades to help the defenses of Richmond?" Basically telling him there are no reinforcements coming up. So this is at the operational level of war.
Right, right.
No reinforcements coming to Lee. The letter from Jefferson Davis is, he's really upset with Lee for making the suggestion about creating an army under Beauregard. And then he goes on to list every brigade in the Eastern Theater and where they are, what their mission is, and why they can't be moved. Okay, this is at the golden gift at the strategic level of war, saying there's no army threatening Washington from the south. Okay, so he tells Klein, take the prisoners to Hagerstown, and he gets on his horse and he rides the 32 miles around the battle and arrives after the Corps Commanders Conference to deliver these dispatches. Now, there was no telegraph between Gettysburg and Washington, so he sent Klein himself to deliver these, and when Stanton read these, Secretary of War Stanton, he poured gold into Klein's hands. He was just so delighted. And then he retransmits both of these messages to all the senior officers in the Union Army in the Eastern Theater, saying, "We have never been able to look inside the enemy like this."
Right.
Okay? So Meade has incredible information. He knows exactly what Lee's reserves are. He knows that Lee is not going to get any reinforcements. And he knows that the strategic threat to Washington from the south does not exist. So he can get the National Command Authority off his back. And he can fight the battle more calm, you know, with calm assurance that he's got everything in hand.
I mean, it just demonstrates how good at something relatively new in document exploitation they had gotten, and understanding like how to take advantage of any kind of situation where there may be mail or documents or dispatches or anything else there. I mean, it's kind of this combination of quasi-signals intelligence, because they're intercepting communications, but at the same time, mail and everything else, and searching prisoners or searching bodies for documents that you can exploit later on for information.
Well, Sharp filed all of this. Is all carefully filed and cross-referenced. In fact, by the Overland Campaign, his organization has 40 wagons filled with documents, which is why he suddenly needed all of these wagons and drivers and everything like this. So everything was at hand.
Well, it's extraordinary how professional they were. I mean, if you include prior to Chancellorsville, so that's going before Gettysburg, you print in the book a full document that is that order of battle. And if you read this and you've seen a modern day intelligence report, there's not a lot of difference, right? This is 150 years old, and this is before there were classes on how to write intelligence reports and how to do analysis and everything. It is about as modern and thorough an intelligence report as it gets.
Oh, it is. It is. I used to do a lot of order of battle work, especially for National Ground Intelligence Center, old Army ITAC. And I was just filled with admiration about how good it was. In fact, right before the Chancellorsville campaign kicked off, Sharp was able to report Lee's actual ration strength within, like, I think 1.5%. That's how good it was. And it doesn't get any better.
Yeah, but this is down to, like, the regimental level and even mm-hmm. below that, where it's not just, oh, Longstreet's corps is over here,
yeah.
you know, and Jackson's, it's going down to, like, you know, colonels and lieutenant colonels, like, where that's information that's amazing.
Well, a lot of this was very useful in cross-checking other information that they would get to ascertain the bona fides of deserters, because Lee would often send men in as deserters to infuse deception into the U.S.
Yeah, I really found analysis. It interesting, the counterintelligence side of dangles and deception operations, and then, of course, counterintelligence in the way of Jeb Stuart, which we can talk about in a second, because that's certainly part of the Gettysburg campaign, mm-hmm. but of trying to cut off the eyes and ears of the BMI, you know, using cavalry and using deception and using all those other things. I mean, you look at the Balloon Corps stuff about Quaker guns and you know, camouflage mm-hmm. and fake campfires and all that. Really extraordinary how advanced some of this counterintelligence was at the time.
One advantage you have to recognize that Sharp had, that everybody had at that time, is that they were dealing with an enemy that spoke their own language, that shared their own customs and traditions. And so you weren't trying to, what is this Russian saying? What is this reference, historical reference to? What does it mean to him? And I found out that we, in real life, you know, today or back then, we didn't understand a lot of these things. My own bias is you need a lot more history and maybe a little less technology, because the history of cultures mm-hmm. and armies will tell you a great deal about how they're going to react. For example, there was, well, I shouldn't get into that.
Well, but I mean, the simple thing is that, you know, every one of these commanders went to the same university. I mean, they all went to West Point, right? You know, every single one of them knew each other. They all fought in the same wars together, the Mexican War. They knew how each other was going to react. And so kind of the cognitive bias that most analysts fall into today of mirror imaging and that's not all problematic at the time, because they are kind of react the way you would expect them to, because they all learn from the same professors at West Point. They all learn from the same war, in the Mexican War. And so you can understand people a little bit better than you might if, you know, fighting the Russians or anybody else.
Still, it was a monumental achievement,
because
it had never been done before. It had never been professionalized like this. In fact, at Appomattox, when the Army of Northern Virginia had to be paroled, Grant gave that job to Sharp. And Sharp apparently knew the order of battle of the Army of Virginia better than a lot of its senior officers.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
The impact of this level of intelligence that had never been seen before, you can see, and you have like basically a chapter per battle, and every single time you can see the impact on this battle. And I hate counterfactual history. No, I don't like the what ifs in a kind of professional sense. I love reading the books for fun, but kind of going back and saying, what would have happened if? I can't say the battles would have been won or lost differently if there wasn't intelligence, but it's clear that intelligence played a vital role in everything starting at Chancellorsville and going all the way up to the end of the war, because you can point to that moment where, whether it's the document about order of battle or whether it's Buford, you know, stealing the march against, you know, the Confederates at Gettysburg, or even things like the analysis about Pickett, all these things are game changers in many respects. And then let's talk about Grant, because we haven't even gotten to that point of the relationship between Grant and Sharp, because when Grant takes over, he's dealing with the similar problem that Meade had and even Hooker before him. And it's about obviously Lee's army, but a very important component of Lee's army is, where the hell is James Longstreet, who's been running around for years at this point, causing havoc for the Union Army and somehow doing it without being seen? Its entire corps of Confederate soldiers moving around and no one really knows where they are.
Longstreet, the primary collection priority, both at Chancellorsville and when the Overland Campaign started, was where is Longstreet? Because at Chancellorsville, he had been sent with two of his divisions south of Richmond for an operation. And before the Overland Campaign, he had been sent out to reinforce Johnston's Army of Tennessee for the Chattanooga-Chickamauga Campaign. So whenever he was going to come, when was he going to show up? I mean, because Confederate First Corps has been called the mightiest offensive organization in the history of the United States.
As if Grant gets bogged down against Lee and all of a sudden Longstreet pops up on his flank, he's in big trouble. You know, that could be a real problem for the, you know, the Northern Army.
I think, though, that the intelligence documentation for the Overland Campaign really thins out, because they were moving 40% of the time, and they literally did not have time to sit down and write all of these detailed reports out, so we don't know that much. But I think Sharp was keeping him fairly well appraised of where Longstreet was. It was just where he was going to show up at that campaign. Now with Grant, Grant comes out to visit the Army of the Potomac right after he's made General in Chief of the Armies. And Sharp has a very positive impression of him. And he ends up making all of these trips over to Grant's headquarters from Meade's headquarters, which are very close. And Grant likes to listen to this stuff. Now, he had been served fairly well in the Western Theater by his intelligence chief. But the Army grinds south through the blood-soaked Overland Campaign. And part of that is due to the fact that Grant is up against a master of the art of war. And I claim that if it hadn't been for Sharp, I think Lee would have fought him to a standstill. But he's getting enough information where he can keep going. But the real moment when Grant became a true believer of Sharp was after the army had settled into the siege of Petersburg. Okay, now Grant wanted to know where all of Lee's corps were. And the First and Third Corps were in the defenses of Richmond and Petersburg. Grant said he wanted the Early's Second Corps to be there. But Sharp keeps telling him, I can't confirm it. But to paraphrase Shakespeare, the wish is father to the thought. Grant wanted him to be there. So he's every little bit of evidence, and it wasn't very much, that indicated they were there, mostly root camp rumors or outright deceptions, he just grabbed a hold of. But what had happened is right before Grant had slipped around the Army of Northern Virginia and crossed the James and besieged Petersburg. The security on both armies was so tight because they were both basically doing much the same thing. The Confederates didn't pick up Grant's move. At the same time, Lee dispatched Early with his second corps into the Shenandoah, and the Union didn't pick that up at that time.
And that's problematic because Jubal Early is marching to Washington, basically.
Right, right. He's marching to Washington, and is, Sharp is getting more and more information that indicates that he's not in the defenses of Petersburg and Richmond, and that he's in the valley, and still Grant won't believe it until you start to get the shrieks of pain from the, you know, the Battle of Monocacy and everything. So suddenly he's had a come to Jesus moment, and he dispatches most of Sixth Corps up there, and they get up there just in time to file into the defenses as Early's about to make an assault on Washington.
Basically walk into Washington, because yeah. Washington had really no defenses to speak of before.
Well, they had stripped them to yeah. reinforce all the losses of the the Overland Campaign. Also, what Grant did is he had sent Sharp up to hold the hand of the National Command Authority. Okay, and I found this in the memoirs of one of Meade's staff officers. You know, the anecdote he told about Sharp going up there and everything like that. So after this, he has no doubt about how valuable Sharp is, because, you know, finally Sharp said they're in the valley, they're marching to Washington. And it was a hairbreadth escape of the Capitol, and that really sobered up Grant. And he transfers Sharp to work directly for his own headquarters. The Army's operating against Richmond. Well, now Meade has a screaming fit over this. He's going to disband the whole BMI, they're worthless, and everything like this. And so what happens when two general officers get into a fight like this? Their staffs get together and kind of work out something, you know. So what they did is, Sharp is up at City Point with Grant, and he's got a bunch of his scouts, but the analytical effort is left with the Army of the Potomac under Babcock and Captain McEntee. But they're all connected by telegraph now. So they're constantly passing information back and forth. Sharp is basically running, he's now the J2, mm-hmm. Army's operating against Richmond. And everybody's still working for him.
Right. Well, now he's created almost an analysis directorate.
Yes.
You know, and then he's got his operations guys with him. That's
yeah. So after this, he and Grant are tight for the rest of their lives.
Well, we're going to get to that in a second, because I think that after the war is interesting. Let me ask you two things before we move to that. One, how much of a trickle-down was there of intelligence information being disseminated to people fighting in the South? I mean, think of someone like Sherman marching to the sea and, you know, people out west. I mean, Grant, since he's put in charge of all the armies, is he pushing out Sharp's intelligence other places?
I didn't come across a lot of that. But I hate to use this word, assume, that it was getting out there. Because I'll give you one example of what I know where it's pushed out. When Longstreet departed with two of his divisions to reinforce Johnston, Sharp picked that up, and that was sent directly to Rosecrans. And it arrived before the Battle of Chickamauga. So he knew Longstreet was going to show up. And he wrote before the battle, he says, send me anything else that Sharp can tell me. Okay, so he's really appreciative of this. This is the only major effort that I've found of the information being passed mm-hmm. out. But the way Grant was working and the way that what Sharp had at his disposal now, I'm sure a lot of it went out. I've just not been able to find it.
You mentioned earlier, and I want to pick back up on this theme, that Sharp was so indispensable to Grant, because Grant really was playing with borrowed time at this point. Because as you mentioned in the book, the North is tired of war. You know, by 64, in the beginning, they're ready for this to end. And Lee could have just kept on playing defense. He could have basically done the Viet Cong mentality of not losing is winning, and just kind of dragged out the war as long as he wanted to. And it was really Sharp's intelligence to help to kind of fix Lee and allow for Grant to destroy him in the end that really wins the war in many respects.
Yes. I would say that the combat multiplier for victory in the Eastern Theater was the intelligence Sharp was reporting. Now, I have to understand, too, that Grant had got a hold of Lee around Richmond and Petersburg, and he wasn't going to let him go. The problem was, could Lee hold out long enough for Union morale to collapse, especially the culminating in the 1864 presidential election? And one of the reasons that Grant was able to keep such a grip on Lee's forces was the intelligence he was getting from the spy mistress of Richmond, who worked for Sharp, Elizabeth Van Loo, one of the most fascinating, heroic women in American history. She had been a member of Richmond society. You know, she had one of these big pillared mansion on the hill, and she had a big truck garden estate outside. And her father had sent her to Philadelphia for her education, and she came back a devoted unionist and abolitionist, and a member of unions. I mean, Richmond society. And she, I guess she kept a lot of this to herself, but she emancipated all of her slaves and then employed them with honest wages. She kept the little Union community together under a lot of Confederate oppression during the war. But she wanted to do more. And so she would go visit the Union officers in Libby Prison and provide them medicines and food and other comforts, blankets and little furniture and books and everything. And even more, because they would occasionally escape, she would have her servants, her black servants, loiter around outside the building to snatch up any of these guys and take them to a safe house. Mm-hmm. Often, it included false room in her attic. And then she would get them out through Confederate lines back into Union control. And as the Overland campaign ground down south, she made it known through General Butler that she wanted to do even more. And then when the siege began, Grant says to Sharp, "Get me inside Richmond." And he knew about Van Loo, so he sends in his new chief of scouts, Judson Knight, and they make contact. And they set up routes where the intelligence can get through the lines and everything. And it was said that flowers from a truck garden would end up on on Grant's breakfast table, with the dew still on them. she had agents in the Confederate War and Navy departments who were working for her, and another major agent was Samuel Ruth, who ran the major Confederate railroad going up towards Fredericksburg. And he had been a Union sympathizer, and what he'd been doing is slowing down everything throughout the war, you know, screwing up the timetables and everything like that. So he's getting a lot of detailed, mostly accurate information. And then as things get worse and worse for Lee, the army is leaking deserters. One other thing that Sharp had done, even before the Overland campaign, he had developed a PSYOPs campaign for the government, basically saying, spreading it out through the Confederates, that if you deserted, right, we will not throw you in a prisoner of war camp, we won't force you to fight in the Union Army, we will send you north and find you a job. And if you came from an area that is now under Union control, you can go home. Okay, this is a brilliant campaign. Right. And then at Petersburg and Richmond, they upped it and they said, "We'll give you a big bounty in Union greenbacks for your weapon." Okay, in fact, it was so advantageous that Union soldiers would desert and then try to come back and pass themselves off as Confederates. So he's helping squeeze. There was one particular episode that I thought was revealing about how bad things were getting with Lee. Lee had ordered a corps attack. I think it was the Third Corps, was it in early March, on the Union lines, and this deserter came in and said, the Corps refused the order to attack. And General Lee wept like a child. Okay. Now I went back and I looked, and there was actually that Corps refused the attack. Hmm. Whether he wept like a child, I don't know. We only have the deserter who said that. But I thought that was an episode in Lee's life that no one had ever come across. But these interrogation reports are filled with fascinating information. Desertions were so bad, especially among the North Carolina troops, that Lee had to detach a brigade to cover all of the bridges over the river that separates Virginia from North Carolina. He was leaking men at a horrendous rate. And of course, Sharp is laying out a honey trail for these guys to follow into Union lines. So his strength is being bled away, even without combat. Now, one other thing that Sharp was intensely interested in and became a high collection priority was what he was picking up. The Confederates were talking about arming slaves, offering them their freedom and that of their families. And this had come from a manifesto written by General Patrick Claiborne, an Irish immigrant who had been called the Stonewall of the West. And he said, we're running out of white manpower. All we have left are our slaves. And we have to decide what is more important, our freedom or slavery, and it's obviously our freedom. So offer freedom to any slave that will fight for the Confederacy. And he asked to read this to all the general officers of the Army of Tennessee. Half of them, among them, many majors, or large slaveholders, agreed with it, said this is idea. Great idea. But one asked for a copy, and he was just incensed at the very idea. Sends it to Jefferson Davis, who orders that all copies be suppressed. This never be discussed again. This was in January of 64. This killed Claiborne's rise in the Army. He had been considered the best division commander in the Confederate Army, and he was slated for a corps. Well, that killed that. Mm-hmm. And he gets killed at Franklin leading his division. Well, by October, Jefferson Davis is so desperate, he's raised the issue on his own now. Okay, and the Union, of course, is picking this up. General Lee said, this is a great idea, you know. He had been opposed to secession. He was not a fan of slavery. So he said, this is a good idea. And you had a lot of officers who volunteered, or people volunteered to be officers in these regiments. Sharp is worried that if they get enough black manpower into the Confederate ranks, it can extend the war beyond the patience of the Northern people.
They're talking about 200,000 or something in that range, I believe, right?
Yeah. And the quality of Union replacements had really fallen off at this time. You weren't getting the yeoman American anymore. You were getting drafted men and bounty men, and all these immigrants signed up right off the boat. And General Horace Porter on Grant's staff said, the Germans were worthless. He said, but the Irish were always up for a fight. Paddy was always up for a fight. And he said, there are no braver men on earth. And so there was this other problem, too, of Union exhaustion. Okay, so he makes this a major collection priority. As it turned out, the South collapsed so fast, even though they had started training some units, that there's very little documentation left because everything collapsed so fast at the end. Just one account of black train guards fought off a Union cavalry attack. That's basically all I've heard about that. But I think this king on this issue was really important because it could have extended the war.
Right.
The war. And Lincoln could have lost the election if things had continued to go badly.
Well, because, I mean, not only losing the election, but the idea is there were a lot of Northerners that were starting to think about conditional surrender and allowing, you know, not kind of letting the South negotiate a surrender and not just straight up.
Well, but see, this is a pipe dream because Jefferson Davis would, one of the world's most inflexible type A personalities, would not countenance anything but outright independence. In fact, at the if you watch the movie Lincoln, mm-hmm. and they have the meeting with the Confederate commissioners, it's not really true what they said, that the big fight was over the 13th Amendment. It wasn't. It was over their inflexible instructions from Jefferson Davis. Lincoln even pushed a piece of paper across to them and said, write across the top Union and Emancipation, and you may write anything else you want below. And still they could not accept it. Yeah. But if the Union people could have been deceived, that's another issue. Because again, the wish is father to the thought. If they so desperately wanted it to be over and they would grasp that straw, who knows?
Let me wrap up by asking, there's so much more to this book, but if we would have 5 hours if we wanted to break it down even more. But after the war, there's an interesting secret mission that Sharp is sent on that I had never heard of. The idea of, after the Lincoln assassination, to try to find out if there are links to Europeans. That itself could be its book.
Not so much to Europeans as to Americans living overseas. Right. Well, see, John Surratt, the son of Mary Surratt, had fled through Canada and he'd gone to Britain. And in January of 66, the Secretary of State Seward asked Sharp to go and find out if anyone, Americans living overseas, had been part of the plot. And he spends almost a year. I think one of the main targets was Judah Benjamin, who had been the Confederate vice president, who had fled, but he couldn't find anything. He went all over France, Italy. He had pursued John Surratt, who was finally arrested on an international warrant in Egypt and sent back on an American warship. And there's a fantastic report in the archives that Sharp wrote on everything he did. He was very prescient over the coming Franco-Prussian War. A big banquet was held in his honor by British society. And one of the guests was a former Confederate officer who said, I have to be on my best behavior because this is the man that signed my parole.
Did he end up signing the parole for any of the top Confederate commanders?
Oh, for Robert E. Lee himself. Yeah. And in fact, one of his proudest possessions was the last order ever issued by Robert E. Lee. It was his pass through the Army of Northern Virginia. And it's in the museum in Kingston, New York, where he's from. Along with the sword he wore at Lincoln's funeral, he was one of the general officer guard of honor, one for representing each state. He represented Georgia. And the sword's hilt still is wrapped in the black crepe that he adorned it with it then. He wouldn't take it off. The war was the defining experience in his life. Even though he had a rich and very fruitful career as a Republican politician in New York, Speaker of the Assembly, Surveyor of the Port of New York, which was the second juiciest plum in the plum book. And Grant gave that to him. Again, a great supporter of African-American civil rights. He was praised even by the Democrats as the Speaker of the Assembly for being a man who would listen and who was honest. Mm-hmm. His last and he was also the corresponding secretary for the Society of the Army of the Potomac, okay? After the war, Sharp was one of the most connected men in the United States. Everybody.
Chester Arthur and all the...
Yeah. Oh, he was responsible for Chester Arthur becoming president.
Yeah.
That's a long story.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, so,
well, read the book to find out about it. I mean, that's the key, right?
And, yeah. One last anecdote about Sharp. He was a very hardworking man as the chief of the BMI. He wrote an uncle, he said... We're the hardest working men in the Army because we're working all the time. You know, even outside of campaigns, we're working all the time. He would even go and brief the pickets on what information he wanted, like, you know, the regiment and the colonel and the strength and everything. So he was telling a story about one Rhode Island soldier who called across the line and said, hey, Reb, What's your regiment? Comes back, 24th South Carolina. How about you, Yank? He said, 147th Rhode Island. You're a damned liar, Yank. There aren't 147 men in that measly little state.
I mean, that's the, they had the. Didn't you write that they kind of ordered them to stop having those kind of conversations down the road a little bit because that was giving up so much information about the order of battle and everything.
Oh, they stopped the exchange of newspapers, which had been a big thing before. The counterintelligence became a big effort as well. He seemed to dabble in just about everything that we do now. The Union also, this wasn't his responsibility, but the Union also had ciphers, telegraphic ciphers. They broke the Confederate one. The Confederates could never break the Union one.
Well, you'd written it at some point that they were reading Union mail and they added a cipher to it, but then they leaked out information over in the clear and actually used
as
it
as a deception
operation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those wonderful tidbits in there where it's we could spend an hour talking about each individual one of those.
Well, I tell you, Sharp, I came to truly admire the man. And then just as I was writing the introduction, I realized what we shared. We each had three children, two boys up front and a daughter, both named Catherine, right? And both our mothers were named Helen. So I thought, hey, I had wanted to go back in time and knock on his door and say, write your damn memoirs.
Right. Well, that was another thing. Everyone wrote their memoirs except... Well,
he didn't because he was going to before he died. His son had been appointed to West Point by Grant, became the quartermaster general of the Army in World War I, father of the modern quartermaster corps. But when he was a lieutenant colonel, he said, Dad, Mom's dead. Come to Washington, stay with me and write your memoirs. But then he died shortly thereafter. So this has required massive research to fill in all the gaps.
Like a true spook, he didn't want anything written down. He wanted to make you work for it. So.
Yes.
The result is the book, Major General George H. Sharp and the Creation of American Military Intelligence in the Civil War. The author is Peter Tesoris. Pete, this book, I'm someone that's always hesitant to dive deeply into a Civil War book just because I was inundated with it as a kid, and it's always one of these things where it's like another Civil War book. But this was just so different because this information just I hadn't read anywhere else. And so even if you're somebody that just read everything there is to read about the Civil War, this brings an entirely new perspective to it because Sharp, like you said, this is the first real biography of an extraordinary man. So thank you so much for being here and taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Spycast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about Spycast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's @INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.